Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is the summer to expand your horizons. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate lightweight, super packable travel shoes from Allbirds. Find your perfect pair at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer and I thank you for joining us. Now, Gab Marcotti is away on business, but alongside me in the studio to help dissect some major issues from the weekend's football, it is Alison Rudd. And down the line, chief football writer at The Times, Henry Winter. Later on, we'll be discussing Liverpool taking the lead in the title race ahead of what is a huge week for them. Plus, were we too quick to write off Cardiff's survival chances? But we start with the major talking point from the weekend, and that is Raheem Sterling. The Manchester City and England star appeared to be the victim of racist abuse during City's defeat to Chelsea at Stamford Bridge on Saturday. On Sunday, Sterling took to social media and said that newspapers fuel racism when it comes to young black players. Matthew Syed joins us now. And Matthew, you've written about this for The Times, and you spoke about football's tribalism spilling over into hatred. Do you think this is a watershed moment?
I think it's a very important moment. Morning, Natalie, Alison, Henry. I mean, I think it's very important to make a distinction between two types of racism. The kinds of racism you sometimes see amongst the minority of football fans is the overt kind of racism that was very common in the United Kingdom and the United States and other parts of the world in the 1970s and 1960s previously, the idea that black people deserve to be called names, that they're somehow subhuman. This was based in a very long pseudo-scientific tradition dating back to an early Swedish taxonomist who categorized Negroid as different to Caucasian, and that these two different races have different moral status. And I think this is a big problem that ran from slavery all the through to Jack Crow segregation, and in the UK until the introduction of the Race Relations Act in the 1960s, which was a seminal moment, I think, in this country. But what Henry's written about today in his extremely in a good and important column is a more subconscious racism and structural racism that I think does exist in the media. And this is where you can't really point to a particular, the N-word isn't used. Nobody would say that anyone has screamed abuse at Raheem Sterling from the pages of any national newspaper. It's much more subtle. It's the kind of racism that sometimes people who are progressive and enlightened are guilty of when they categorize and stereotype people of a different color rather than treating them as individuals and come up with pejorative interpretations of what they do. Now, I've written about this contrast very, very many times in my columns for The Times, but I think Henry's right. This is a very important moment, I think, for the media to take a long, hard look at itself. It's very difficult for us as journalists to say that because we work in the media, but I think it is important, and who knows, I think it could lead to very serious and important change.
Henry, you've also written about this for The Times. Sterling highlighted contrasting coverage of two young City players, Tosin Adarabayo and Phil Foden, buying houses. Sterling writes, both play for the same team. Both have done the right thing, which is buy a new house for their mothers, who've put in a lot of time and love into helping them get where they are. But look at how the newspapers get their message across. This is what Sterling said for the young black player and then for the young white player. The headlines refer to Adarabayo buying a £2 million house despite having never started a Premier League match, whereas Phil Foden was described as buying a £2 million house for his mum. Is the coverage of him in sections of the media, Henry, influenced then by his skin colour, do you think?
Definitely. Sadly, this is nothing new. I wrote a book with John Barnes 20-odd years ago, and, you know, he had... there was a piece in one of the papers which really questioned his right to play for England. Jamaican-born, but obviously grew up over here, played for sort of local teams in London, then obviously made his name at Watford, then on to Liverpool. And yet, there was a particularly virulent piece in one of the newspapers, I think it was in 93, before the San Marino game, and he walked out with just such abuse. I think he actually scored, which sort of silenced a few people. But so the connection was there, and you think we sort of tried to grow up as a society and as a sport, but I think what's happened recently has shown that we've still got a long way to go. The abuse that Raheem Sterling endured at the weekend, I mean, it's still got to be proven exactly what was said. But I think when the criticism of Raheem Sterling, which it is slightly sinister at times in parts of the media, little things, you know, that he goes into Greg's. I mean, I went to see, I think we talked about it before, I went to see him at his house, and he was just sort of like, I mean, he's quite a laid-back individual. He was saying, why are they interested in me going to Greg's to get a pasty, I think it was? Why are they interested in me taking EasyJet? The one that really got to him was the going for breakfast with his fiancée the day after he didn't pick up the award for young player. The year, I think Sané won it. Now, he was in peace with Sané, sent him a message, congratulated him, and yet there was someone was trying to sort of stir a little bit of sort of tension there by saying, you know, he drowned his sorrows by going off an orange juice at breakfast. It was a sort of bizarre story. And I know we've had sort of comparisons with what Rooney went through, what Gazza went through, but the depiction of Gazza was almost like a sort of lovable rogue, whereas the depiction of some young black players by certain parts of the media, only a few, and I know they're having a little bit of soul-searching at the moment, judging by the phone calls I've had, is actually sort of unpleasant. And I think Raheem Sterling has done everyone, the sport and the media long-term, a huge favour by talking out on it yesterday, by saying there is a link between the depiction of young black English footballers and some of the abuse that they endure in matches.
Well, in November, the anti-discrimination charity and PFA-funded partner Kick It Out released figures that showed reports of discriminatory abuse within football went up 11% last season. That's 2017-18. That's the sixth annual rise successively. Of the 520 reported incidents, 53% were racism related. That's a 22% increase from the previous season. Alison, how bad is this? It's as simple as that to ask. This is just, when you read these figures, it's just shocking.
Well, it's deeply worrying that there is a statistical increase. We can show there's an increase in racial hatred and hate crime. And I think one explanation for that is the whole debate around Brexit, because I think that gives a sheen of validity to talking about otherness and us and them. And one of the problems with Brexit is it is creating a climate of uncertainty, and when people are worried about the economy and their own jobs and their own lives and rifts in families because people are divided on this issue, people close in and they create narratives about people that are the enemy within. And it's, you could argue, we're quite a nasty country at the moment in some respects. But I would like to ask a question which I think is a difficult one, but I'm really interested in Henry and Matt both answering this. Henry, you say in your piece today in The Times, you go through with a breaking news motif. You're sort of telling the readers about how Raheem Sterling in particular, the stories have been written with a specific narrative in mind, and actually you contradict the headline with the truth of it. We've also got a photograph in The Times where we circle the middle-aged Chelsea fan having a horrible, screaming, contorted go at Raheem Sterling. Do you think, Henry and Matt, that we should circle the editors or the writers in the papers that have written the headlines and the stories and out them? Because Raheem Sterling has said, effectively, he doesn't really blame the fans. He thinks they're sort of idiots who just sop up the propaganda from the papers who've portrayed him and other black players in a ridiculously negative light.
So I would like to talk about, and I'll come on to what you asked, Alison, directly, but with just a little bit of background. A few years ago, a couple of economists sent 5,000 CVs to employers And on half of the CVs, they put archetypal black names like Latoya and Tyrone. And on the other half, they put archetypal white names like John and Susan. The CVs were otherwise identical, so all of these people had the same credentials. The employers, I don't think, were racist. They didn't think of themselves as racist. They wouldn't use the N-word. They wouldn't use the P-word. I think they would condemn what they saw amongst Chelsea fans. But the people with white-sounding names were 50% more likely to get invited to a job interview. This kind of experiment has happened in the United States. It's happened in the UK and in other Western nations that like to think of themselves as pretty progressive. So I think this is it's often a subconscious thing. I don't think any journalist thinks of themselves as racist. But I think what Henry drew attention to today is the nuances that can be introduced into coverage, often in an entirely subliminal way, that create a climate in which a more extreme form of racism can flourish. But it is quite unusual for us to turn in and to start analyzing ourselves as journalists and in the media. So in answer to your question, no, I don't want to see sports editors circled. I don't want to see necessarily journalists circled. I want us to take a long, hard look at ourselves and to understand that one can make a structural critique without necessarily wanting to vilify any given individual journalist.
But do you not think, Matthew, that the person who decided to portray young white footballers' big spend as altruistic and lovely and decided to portray a young black player's big spend as slightly odd and selfish and indulgent, given he hasn't done very much yet with his young life, don't you think it would be the next step for that person to say why they did that, to explain why they did that?
I wouldn't have a problem with that at all. If one could come up with something approaching a systematic analysis of how different patterns exist between different types of people, I'd like that. I mean, I know, for example, that there has been the retort that David Beckham was treated sometimes unfairly and pejoratively. Wayne Rooney, I think, has also suffered from that. I would argue that many footballers are treated badly, often because they're from working-class backgrounds. But I think it's quite difficult to necessarily say that in any given contrast between two stories, there is a racist component of an overt sense. But yes, it would be a good idea for editors, if it was the same editor on the same day who commissioned the two pieces and was able to articulate why that difference happened. I'd love to see that. But of course, it may have been two different editors from two different papers on two different days. So I'll just be cautious about the singling out of specific people in this case. I think it's a much more subtle structural critique that we need to focus on.
I'd also like to stick up for some of the sports editors, because when there have been incidents of racism towards English players, under 21, Serbia, 2004 at the Bernabeu when England played Spain and Ashley Cole and Emil Heskey were racially abused by Spanish fans, the reaction was that 14 years ago, the reaction across Calixto in inverted commas, across media organisations on the sports pages, was absolutely to call the Spanish to account.
Yeah, agreed, Henry. And you also, am I right in thinking, Henry, you tweeted a statement from an organisation that represents black journalists? I've been struck, and it's quite difficult to say, because obviously we're employed within the media, at the lack of black and ethnic minority journalists in sport. There's also an incredible dearth of women who work as journalists in sport. I mean, for what it's worth, I think there's a very serious deficit of black and ethnic minority journalists who write at the front of the newspaper in many top titles. And I think we're losing the diversity of experiences and opinions that are so important in our public sphere. And we have lacked for decades. And I think this is a major problem in democracy, that we don't have those voices, we don't have these experiences, we don't have these points of view that I think are of such significance for understanding where we're at as a country, where we're at as a sporting infrastructure. And I think the more we can highlight and draw attention to this, the better.
We should also stress how brave a statement it was from Raheem Sterling. And Matthew, let me ask you about the photo of Sterling smiling in the face of the abuse that he received on Saturday night. We should remind people it was his birthday as well. How powerful an image is that?
Well, funnily enough, I was watching on the television with my son, Teddy. He's just coming up to five years old, and he has become completely obsessed with football. We watched the Match of the Day highlights on Sunday mornings. He was talking about the game most of the way through Saturday. We left his school fate early to get back. And he said, as we were watching it in real time on the television, because it was such a close-up of Sterling by the advertising hoardings and the three fans in particular on the front row, they were screaming at Sterling, and he asked me about it, and I said, oh, that just happens in football. And he looked very confused, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to pause this, and I rewound it and asked my wife what she thought was being said. And it's worth saying that we don't know for sure. It's very difficult to lip read. I think we can say that they were being abusive, but we can't say for sure that this was racism. I think the presumption of innocence should apply, and any decision about guilt should only be taken through the due process. But then I uploaded it onto the social media, the clip, because I wanted to see what other people thought and at least to alert the authorities. And it was at that point, I think, that I realized, you know, what a ridiculously risible excuse it is to say, oh, you know, football is just one of those sports where people are tribal and they hold abuse at each other and we shouldn't sanitize football. We should sanitize football. We should sanitize it of racism, homophobia, anti-Semitism, but also that gamut of abuse around celebrating the Munich air disaster, you know, mocking the victims of Hillsborough. You know, for me, you can be tribal and you can be passionate about your team without descending into that kind of invective.
Well, this statement from Sterling came 7 days after a banana was thrown in the direction of Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang in the North London derby. John Barnes this morning has spoken about everything, saying as much as overt racism in football had seemed to have disappeared, I, for one, never believed that it did. Other former footballers like Robbie Earle and Jason Roberts have come out and say that they feel that they failed the generation of today. Has football been turning a blind eye to all of this, Henry?
What we've also got is social media. I mean, the abuse that black players and female sports presenters, and I'm sure you've had it, on social media is horrific. Just echoing Matthew's point about sort of, you know, the general abuse that goes on in football. The social media, I mean, everyone's got a platform now to make a point, to have a view, and it's important in terms of sharing information and contact with people and communication generally. But some of the abuse that goes on is extraordinary. And I'm bored writing this and saying this, but you know, Twitter needs to, if people want to have a go at me, I'm fine. I'm a middle-aged white guy, and you know, what they're going to call me, and then I get called a posh, whatever. But actually, the abuse that I mean, even some of the comments on, you know, this sort of discussion about what Raheem Sterling, you know, the points that he's been raising, some of the comments, you think, my God, you know, these people are just, you know, they're recidivists, they're Neanderthals. How have we got these people still in the 21st century? So I think Twitter and Facebook and even people like that do need to actually have a look and react quicker, because, I mean, I know black players who've had to go off Twitter in particular because they found it too toxic there and they didn't want their families to read it, so they just closed their accounts down. And that's embarrassing for society in the 21st century.
This season, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you can watch every highlight and every goal from every game in the Premier League. It's just £8 for an 8-week trial. Defeat at Stamford Bridge saw Manchester City lose the leadership of the Premier League to Liverpool after Jurgen Klopp's men ran riot at the Vitality Stadium on Saturday lunchtime. Mo Salah scoring a hat-trick as Liverpool won 4-0. Many, including ourselves, have spoken about how Liverpool are struggling, that they're hanging on in the title race. And yet here we are, top of the table, and the only unbeaten side in the top five divisions, Alison.
Yeah. it's good for football, as they kept saying on every outlet over the weekend. It's fascinating. I like the narrative. I think it's really interesting because even though Chelsea played incredibly well for a large chunk, not all of it, a large chunk of the game, and City, for all their pressing and tactical acumen, didn't really look like they were going to score. A lot of the subtext to, oh, it's good for football and we have a title race on our hands, is that City is still playing the superior form of football. I don't quite know where we got, how we got to this, where where you're supposed to get more points for playing superior football. They'll probably win the title on goal difference, and that's the advantage they'll get. Liverpool, I think, deserve a lot of credit for the way. They're churning out results without making anyone gush, but it's really grown up, joined up thinking football. They're doing what they need to do for each opponent. Their clean sheet stats are phenomenal. You can sort of see already how Liverpool are not trying to out-oomph City. They're not trying to seduce us. They're just playing to what strengths they have in the moment. There'll be a lot of people thinking, well, this is just a blip and City will storm ahead. But I do think there's something about the way that Liverpool are hanging in there, and with a sense that there is much more to come. And it may be, that the beautiful goal that Salah scored, that lovely trickery, as you say, rounding the keeper twice, with such calmness, this is the moment when we've often said how teams fear City, and that almost hands them the title because they're not even trying, they're just containing. Maybe this is the moment when teams think, oh no, not Mo Salah, and that gives a good old psychological edge to Liverpool. But yeah, what a race we have in our hands.
Oh, it certainly is exciting. And Henry, as for Mo Salah, many have said he's not in the same exhilarating form as last season, yet he is now the joint top scorer in the Premier League. So have we been guilty of over-analysing his performances?
I think everyone was expecting a little bit of a fallow sort of plateau period for him after the injury, the World Cup. You know, yeah, quite a few players have come back for the World Cup and have had a dip. But I think everyone who sort of saw him last season just knew, just could see the talent there. And what I think he voted in Football of the Year, you could see that Liverpool team, emotionally and tactically, was set up to bring out the best out of Mo Salah. And, you know, as Alison rightly points out, you know, the goals at the weekend were fantastic. They were always coming because he's a class act. He's a dedicated professional. What I particularly liked about him, as well as the balance and that little burst of pace and, you know, just the composure in the box, was a couple of times when he could have gone down, could have got a free kick, could have got a penalty, and actually sort of stayed on his feet. And, you know, what a fantastic, you know, lesson that is, you know, for some fellow professionals to see, as well as kids watching. So, look, you know, he's a true sporting champion in every sense. So, no, that's brilliant. As Alison rightly says, you know, we do have a title race on our hands here. And what I particularly like, and again, it reflects very well on the club and on Jurgen Klopp, is that it's only about an hour ago that they announced a new contract for Joe Gomez. So obviously got the injuries out for a little while, unfortunate injury. And, you know, what a great thing that is to actually do to a player. Maybe that it was timed that it was going to happen anyway, but I think, you know, psychologically for him to have that love of the coach and the club and the teammates wrapped around him with a new contract is great.
You both mentioned we've got a title race on our hands. Is it still a two-horse race, or can we now include the likes of Tottenham, Chelsea and Arsenal as well? I know they're a few more points behind, but the way they're playing, the way they're performing, can we add more to the mix, Alison?
Probably not, except that I think those clubs will have a huge bearing on where the title ends up, because I was sat watching Chelsea play Fulham, and although they won, the general mood was, oh my goodness, if they play like this against Man City, they're going to get absolutely trashed. And they didn't. So for it to continue to be a title race, you need clubs of the calibre of Chelsea and Tottenham and Arsenal to, instead of quivering when they face cities, to actually have the self-belief that they can overcome them. That's how you get a title race. Because I don't think at the moment, as it stands, those teams face Liverpool think they can't get a result from them. Last season, there was a sense that they did feel that. So if there is a level playing field, if you like, that the bigger clubs with all the talent feel, hang on, we're not just going to give City this one. We feel we can work as hard as them, and we've got some flair too. They will have a say in the title race. I'm just not so sure that come the end of the season, it will be one of those that have won it.
So it is Liverpool who are top of the table. They're obviously very happy at the moment. The mood, though, could change very quickly. They host Manchester United at Anfield next Sunday. But before that, it is a make-or-break clash with Napoli in the Champions League. Liverpool have to win So the question is, which Liverpool will we see? The all-out attack or perhaps the more reserved, solid unit that we've seen often this season? And let's not forget that Carlo Ancelotti has won the Champions League 3 times. Napoli beat Liverpool in Naples. So it is set up for a classic, isn't it, under the lights at Anfield, Henry?
Oh, absolutely. It's got a touch of the Olympiacos. Go back to the 70s and Saint-Étienne. You know, the Kop will be in full roar. It'll be an amazing atmosphere. It'll buzz. People will get to the ground early. And that adrenaline is huge. But, I mean, Napoli, and as you say, Ancelotti, I don't think they'll be particularly daunted by it. I mean, you know, they're used to playing in front of sort of passionate crowds, so, you know, in their own stadium. So, absolutely, they will be up for it. But you can just see Liverpool surfing that wave of adrenaline from the fans and that being just so important for them. They know that the score is. I don't think we'll see particularly reserved football from Klopp's side. I don't think he knows that. He's far more sophisticated than the heavy metal image portrayed when he first came over. Look, he sorted out the defence as well. That's a fantastic back five, goalkeeper, and then obviously the back four. Virgil van Dijk's probably in the top 2-3 centre-halves in the world at the moment in terms of his ability on the pitch, the aerial strength. He's good with the ball at his feet, but also as a leader in the dressing room. In a game where there aren't so many leaders anymore, he's a real presence in every sense. So it's going to be absolutely a special night there.
Just to let you know exactly the permutations then, Liverpool have to win either 1-0 or by 2 clear goals. A 2-1 win or a 3-2 win, for example, would see Napoli progress on the head-to-head record, having scored away goals. Alison, briefly on this, can Liverpool do it?
Of course they can do it. Yeah, no, they
will they do it then?
I was in Naples visiting Napoli on Sunday and my taxi driver asked me what I thought the score would be and I think I've jinxed it because I said 2-1.
Oh.
And he went, hooray! And I said, yeah. What do you mean, hooray? And they went, oh, no. No, no, no. I meant 3-1, but I didn't, did I? I said 2-1. So anyway, but I'm sure Liverpool won't and Klopp won't forget the permutations. I think it'll be tight from what I can gather from my trip to Napoli. They're not scared. They're not going to play for the draw, which would do them just fine. They feel they can score. They feel they're on a great run of form. They've got a manager now. They've moved from Sarri, who only played with, only used 14 players all season, to a manager, Ancelotti, who's using the entire squad. And so they'll be, it's harder in that sense for Liverpool to prepare for them. They're rested. They rested, I think, 6 players at the weekend. They will be going. They're feeling fresh, focused, full of self-confidence. Ancelotti, from what I can gather, is the most laid-back manager. And if he is feeling nervous about what, as Henry described, will be a cauldron of atmosphere and with a history of pulling off unlikely wins, he's not letting the players feel it. So I think it might be quite a classy game of football. It might not just be one on passion. I think the team that lifts their game best on the night and plays the prettiest football might win it, actually.
Now, Ralph Hasenhüttl's reign at Southampton began in inauspicious fashion, losing his first game in charge away to relegation rivals Cardiff on Saturday. The Bluebirds have won 4 of their last 5 home games and are now up to 14th in the table. Now, Alison, there was plenty of talk of Cardiff being doomed before a ball was even kicked, that they might be the worst team in Premier League history as well, but they're making a real fist of this, aren't they?
Yeah, and it's not, I think, the current view of Cardiff is, well, they've got a great backing at home and, you know, anything can happen with home support and you can creep over the line in a close match with that. They actually got promotion via lots of negative adjectives. They were considered the thugs of the Championship and that they bulldozed their way to the Premier League. And that is, I think, why they started the season with most people, me included, thinking they just wouldn't be able to hack it in the Premier League. The Premier League style of football would just be too clever for them. They didn't have enough intelligent players to cope. But what surprised me the most was the first time I saw them live this season was at West Ham, and there was a large chunk of that game where they were outplaying West Ham. They were being really intelligent. Junior Hoylett's pace was, they were completely flummoxed by it. They were prepared to put lots of men forward. I thought I was going to see the odd counter-attack, but I saw sustained attacks, intelligent attacks, brave attacks. even though they don't have a they don't have a striker, they were going for it. And I think if you've got that sort of attitude, then you will get points at home when perhaps you shouldn't. And I think part of the negativity around Cardiff was also because of their manager, because Neil Warnock is seen to be at 70 somebody who should know his place. He's somebody who can get you promotion, or he can do okay in a lower division. But when it comes to the Premier League elite, he's too old school, doesn't quite get it, doesn't go to clubs with big budgets. He'll be found out. But actually, you have to hand it to him the way he's conducted himself. As far as I'm aware, he doesn't slag off his players in public. He's always saying, even when they haven't played that well, and there have been games where they haven't played well, he's really praised the team's attitude to the hilt, their effort, their self-belief, confidence, togetherness. He stresses that an awful lot. And I think if you're a small club with a small budget, juggling around, I mean, Patterson was a fullback, and then Warnock played him as a midfielder, and now he's playing him as an emergency striker, which sounds a bit of a joke, but something like that can work, and can only work in a climate of togetherness and camaraderie and belief. You know, you could argue that was the managerial amazing moment of the weekend, not Maurizio Sarri or Jurgen Klopp. It was doing that. I mean, he's got nothing to work with. And to forge you in when you're playing against a team with the new manager bounce as well. Gave the new manager a long chat before kickoff. I'd love to know what he said. But it was as if he was being, yes, welcoming, but also saying, I've seen it all, mate. You've got a lot to learn.
That's true. So do you think he can prove people wrong then, that he can actually keep Cardiff up? Because he's only ever successfully completed one Premier League season, and that obviously ended in relegation for Sheffield United.
Mm. Yeah, well, those sorts of runs are there to be ended, aren't they? And there's a phrase, you can't put a price on experience, and at some point his experience has to matter. So I think it's possible, definitely.
I know that when I saw Cardiff in the Championship last season, they were one of those teams, especially when they got off to such a good start, and you thought, they'll fall away. They'll fall away. They're not good enough to sustain it. But they did, because they were that strong unit that, you know, like a team like Brentford, when we came up against them, they were so physical, but in the positive way, they were able to stifle us so easily that I can see why they actually got promoted in the end.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I think, and I fell into this trap, if it is a trap as well, between Cardiff and Fulham. Fulham played very beautiful football. It was erroneous, but they were called the Man City of the Championship. They weren't really that at all. But they did play expansively, and they erred on the side of creativity, and they spent a lot of money in the summer. So there was an assumption that the nice team would do well in the Premier League, and the team that didn't spend a lot of money and the team that bruised their way to promotion would be the one that fell away, which was illogical, because Cardiff finished above Fulham in the Championship. They had what it took to avoid the playoffs. That means a lot. And instead of seeing that as a good character trait, and it is, you know, who wants to be in the lottery of the playoff system? You don't. You just really don't. So he avoided that. Warnock avoided that, and he came up and kept the same approach and attitude, and Fulham made the mistake of just buying in lots of new faces, and now they've changed the manager, haven't been able to replicate what got them promotion, whereas Cardiff have. And that, again, is something that was too readily overlooked.
It is time now for our weekly predictions game, where we pick five matches from the weekend and try and predict the score. And these are the results from the games that we picked. So it started off pretty well for Gab on Friday night. He does know everything about Serie A, and he predicted the exact scoreline of Juventus 1, Inter Milan 0. But because I'm a bit of an expert when it comes to the Football League, I successfully called a result of Colchester 1, Macclesfield 0 in Sol Campbell's first league game in management. When it came to predicting the Premier League, well, it was a bit of a one-sided affair, I'm afraid. I'll give credit to Gab. He predicted that Manchester City would slip up at Chelsea, but we can't give him any points as he plumped for the draw. And Gab also expected Liverpool and Tottenham to draw ahead of their big Champions League deciders, but I correctly predicted victories for both, meaning, yet again, I win this week, taking my overall lead now to 9-5 this season. I'm just sad that Gab's not here for me to gloat even more, but I look forward to seeing Gab on Thursday when we go again for the next round of predictions. It is time now for Gab's favourite feature, Quick Hits. And Alison, I'm not going to impose the usual time restraints on you that Gab usually does. But here we go. Arsenal make it 21 games unbeaten in all competitions as they leave it late to beat Huddersfield 1-0 at the Emirates. But as our qualified referee, what do you make of the Gunners having not one, not two, but three players booked for simulation? That was Xhaka, Mustafi and Guendouzi.
I think all three were acceptable yellow cards. More importantly, the debate about simulation and booking is that if referees take a strict view of it and players are booked and then it is highlighted on TV and in podcasts and in the papers, that players will be embarrassed and they will stop doing it. I think the fact that three players from the same team did it in the same game proves that's a fallacy. They don't care, do they? I mean, if it's hardly a deterrent. Oh, my teammate's just been booked for simulation. Oh, I'll do it. Oh, my previous two teams, I'll do it again. In fact, if this is trend is going to continue and we're going to see multiple bookings for different types of simulation in a game, it's like overkill and players will not be embarrassed. It'll just become part of... Sometimes a player will foul an opponent and they'll get booked for it, but the general view is, well, he took one for the team, it was an important foul to make, it was necessary for him to get booked, otherwise they were going to probably get a goal on the break, and he did the right thing. It was cynical, but it's not really frowned upon to do that, and I think we're in danger of turning simulation from something that was regarded as disgraceful and nasty part of the game, something you didn't want to see, into something that's, well, it's so commonplace that I'm not going to be embarrassed because I've got loads of friends and teammates who've done the same thing. So I think it's slightly worrying.
Tottenham are enjoying their best ever start to a Premier League season as Dele Alli scores his 50th goal for Spurs in the 2-0 win at Leicester. He's only 22, Alli. We've been going crazy about Jadon Sancho, who, by the way, scored the winner for Dortmund against Schalke on Saturday. But as England fans, Alison, have we forgotten about Dele?
Yeah, what we tend to do is if players abroad, we tend to think that they're something special, and because we don't see them a lot, they look exotic somehow because they're playing a different league. Ooh, fancy that. And therefore, if they're starring in another league, they must be amazing. Whereas, in fact, that doesn't make any sense because the Premier League is the best league in the world. So I think we take for granted young players, talented young players, who are in front of us all the time. And I don't think that Dele Alli had such an amazing game against Leicester. What I think was noteworthy was that he was given a lot of responsibility by the manager. There was no Eriksen to be creative. There was no Harry Kane to supply the expected goal. So he was trying to fill that void, do a grown-up job, knit the team together, and he did that. And occasionally he's rested. He has to be at that age, I think. But what's interesting about Dele Alli is whenever he comes back from a rest or an injury or whatever the reason he's not been playing for a bit, he always looks better. So I think the future's bright.
Well, it's been a wonderful week for West Ham. Three Premier League wins in 7 days as they see off Crystal Palace 3-2. Manuel Pellegrini says the Hammers should be aiming for the top six. Is that realistic?
It's not. Well, it's only unrealistic in that I think you could probably make a case for six teams that might get there before them. But in terms of where they're at the moment, they always look capable of conceding. So I don't, you know, that any team that has that feel about them, and they were picked apart by Manchester City not so long ago. And I think while it's acceptable to say, well, of course we lost to Man City, I don't think it's acceptable to leak quite so many goals against them. You've got to prove that you can be stoic at the back. I don't think they look particularly stoic at the back, but going forward, they have so much flair. I think they'll probably outscore most teams away from the top four or five. And I have no objection to the manager saying he's aiming for the top six. That's his job, I think, to boost confidence, optimism, make the fans sing a bit louder. They're a very attractive team to watch, and I love Robert Snodgrass.
Good to see him doing well then. Great goal as well that he scored.
Bob Snod. Bob Snod is God.
Oh, I like it.
I have a question for you, Natalie.
Oh.
Is this the first time I've ever asked you a question?
I think so. I like it though.
I'm feeling slightly nervous. There was a record crowd at Accrington Stanley. Who were they? On Saturday. But I hear it all went a bit wrong. What happened, Natalie?
Yes, yes. There was a record attendance, as you say, of 5,257 at the Crown Ground as Sunderland headed to Accrington for the first time. But alas, whether we can actually ever officially record this attendance is another matter, because with the game poised at 1-1, the referee in the 73rd minute had to abandon the match. Yes, due to a waterlogged pitch. The game had been in doubt prior to kickoff due to heavy rain, leaving the pitch sodden in places. But with the weather turning and the surface playable, the referee got the game underway, only for the downpour to return, and with player safety in mind, the game was called off. Now, had the deluge held off for another 20 minutes or so, the game would have been completed, but sadly wasn't to be. So those goals, the scoreline, the attendance, well, maybe that's all going to be expunged from the record books as if it never happened.
With the emphasis on sponge.
Sponged. Indeed. That is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, Alison Rudd, Matthew Side and Henry Winter. Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information. We'll be back on Thursday to look ahead to Liverpool versus Manchester United.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.